Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Forgecast. My name's Sam Towns.
I'm Alex Norton.
I'm Steve Schwarzer.
That's right. We have an awesome guest for you this week. But before we get to him, let's take a moment to thank our sponsors.
This week's Forgecast is heating its ear billets in your ear, Forgers, thanks to the knife-making supply company extraordinaire Nordic Edge. Everything from materials to the tools you need to work them can be found at their easy-to-use website. So give them a visit at nordicedge.com.au after the show to stock up today. And don't forget to say hi to them at the Perth Knife Show this weekend if you're in the area.
Yeah. Right across from me.
Yeah,
I'll be on the other side waving.
What have you been up to this week, Sam?
Well, before we get to me, thank you so much for joining us, Steve, on the show. Yeah. Greatly appreciate it.
You're welcome.
My week's just been flat out making preparations for Perth Knife Show, to be honest. It's, you know, as we record this, there is today and tomorrow left before the show starts, so... I've been madly working my butt off. I was working until like 11 o'clock last night. And I'll probably be doing the same today, just getting everything sorted. Making good progress, though. I'm pretty happy with where I'm at as far as stuff I've got to take. Friday will probably be spent just packing and getting things organized, getting ready to go. Because I'm heading down there to the hotel Friday night, so... that I can be up early enough in the morning to put something on the table for judging. So hopefully.
Excellent. So you're going up for awards at the, you're putting things forward for awards at the Perth Knife Show?
Just one. Like I haven't made any knives this year that I believe are worth judging. So, but I do want to put the Dragon Hammer up for the best of the rest.
Excellent.
Cause they have like a category for stuff that isn't knives. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, other than that, that's basically just like controlled my life for the last 3 weeks. You know, everyone knows I've been talking nonstop about it. I've got my dad actually made a box for one of my beginner engraver sets, so I'll have one of those with me at the show. I'll have a couple of Sloyd knives, which I'm currently working on. I've got my 10 hex hawks. I've got 4 hammers. I've got the Dragon Hammer. I've got the Mountain Hammer. I've got a little kindling axe that I made ages ago. It's a little forge welded edge, like Viking style axe, but it's about, you know, weighs about half a pound. it's a tiny little thing. That's basically it. I've also got a saber that I'm working on that I'll see if I can get finished. I've got to kind of pull my thumb out and get that going. But as to my song of the week, I've been listening to a lot of like new stuff and old stuff and just kind of playing around with all of the different, like I've been listening to the Forgecast playlist a lot. So, you know, I'm always a bit out of a loss to choose what I should pick because I'm like, I've already got this on the show. But, a song that I consistently listen to, regularly these days is a song by Iron and Wine. And it's called Upward Over the Mountain.
Right.
My favorite version of it is not on Spotify. It was a live recording in the Yellowstone Ranges with Andrew Bird. And it's a, like, if you go on YouTube, you can find it. It's an absolutely stunning song. It's a very vibey kind of song. It's very low, very slow. And the lyrics are really, really awesome. So definitely recommend listening to that. I actually listen to it to go to sleep every night. So, so it's a good song. But with that being said, what have you been up to, Alex?
I've been working on a set of 4 backlog folders. And just trying to get, same as when I did the pair of daggers recently, I'm trying to work on my consistency, being able to make the, you know, and two things in the knife making world that require a lot of very close tolerances and attention to detail is daggers and backlocks. And yeah. So I'm really pushing myself to try and get that consistency down, not just in visual appearance, but in feel, which you don't really get as much on a dagger. It's more about fit and finish. Whereas on backlocks, that walk and talk is everything. And so trying to get consistency in that is a whole different kettle of fish. So I've been making a set of four backlocks to try and do that. Just one after the other, dialing in the mechanisms to try and get them to feel the same as well as look the same. So it's been a bit of a personal challenge for myself. They're coming together not as quickly as I'd like. Doing four backlocks at once is an interesting exercise in going insane. But it's normally I do one knife at a time. But I also have been upgrading my solar powered workshop to have a higher battery capacity, which is, you'd think, is just slapping extra batteries in. But the more batteries you have in parallel in a or in series, I should say, in a solar setup, the more dangerous it becomes for risk of fires and higher current and things. So it has to be done very carefully and very specifically for a homemade job like this one. Part of it is also working on the YouTube tutorial that I'm going to be putting out on how to convert your workshop to be totally off grid. So nice. Getting lots of interesting data, because when it comes to solar power, the on paper maths is very different to the real world maths, because you're linking in with nature, which is inherently unpredictable. So it's interesting watching the data come in, which will all be in the video, which hopefully should help a lot of people. And I've also been doing a lot of planning and sketching and CAD work to plan out my Trident main Gauss build that's coming up, trying to get the mechanism where I'm happy with it. Originally, I was going to have a button release for it, but I thought it might be fun to have a ring guard on it where tilting the ring guard releases the two all blades. Right. I thought that'd be cool. I'm really looking forward to making this build. I mean, it's totally impractical. A Trident main gash is it's a very impractical thing to build, but this is sort of what I'm gearing up for with all this testing of my consistency of mechanisms and things like that. So
you know what'd be really cool is, instead of like a spring loaded, having them geared to the ring, so that
what, like Alain Vallette with the music box knives that he does?
It's sort of, but when you turn the ring, it just like it opens them with a gear.
Oh, don't put that idea in my head. Now I'm gonna want to do that. This build is going to send me insane. And I know that no matter how, because a good friend of the show, Niels Vandenberg, is also going to be making one. He reckons in about July, if all things go well, because he's going to be traveling for a bit. And I know no matter what I do, no matter how good it is, no matter how snappy and perfect it is, and I'm going to be very proud of it. And then I'm going to see Niels Vandenberg do it, and it's going to be exquisite. And it's going to be, you know, crisp as anything, and I'm going to feel bad. I just don't.
I'm sure you'll do well.
We're on to you, Niels.
Always.
My song of the week is a classic. It's by Thin Lizzy off their album Thunder and Lightning. It's The Boys Are Back in Town. It's one of my favorite songs. It's a classic. And I was actually lucky enough to get to go to Dino's Bar and Grill. It's in Las Vegas. It's a dive bar in Las Vegas. And it's a hoot of a place to go. It's really out of the way. You can walk there from the strip. And it's a really great place to go, especially if you go into the bathroom, because it's full of graffiti from a lot of big names. And you can sort of spot them if you spend enough time in there. And it's a cool place, and it was a bit of a I've been a fan of that song since I was a little kid, and the meaning of the song and the lyrics sort of change the older you get, but the getting to actually go there was a surreal experience. But I don't know, that song is always, it always is an uplifting sort of song. It always gives me energy when I listen to it, and as soon as it starts, it's one of those songs that the opening chord, you recognize the song immediately.
Yeah, I immediately get sent to A Knight's Tale with...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Heath Ledger.
So, yeah, that's me. I've been listening to a lot of older songs from, I've got a 60s and 70s playlist that, you know, the listeners of the show know I like to categorize my playlists. And I often find, because, you know, you got my app that I use for the music, it doesn't let me hit shuffle and it'll pick a random song for me. I have to pick a starting song and then it'll shuffle from there. So what song I start my day on is it's often The Boys Are Back in Town, because if you feel like a boss opening the doors to your workshop, Boys Are Back in Town playing. But yeah, that's been my week. Steve, what have you been up to this week?
Oh, I've been just laying around resting.
Yeah.
I've been burning the candle at both ends. I'm working on some new pattern development. You guys were talking about your playlist on your song. I don't do much music. I did about 130 audio books in the last year and a half. I'm reading prolifically when I work. It's white noise. I get easily distracted. But most of the music I do is pretty strange. It's like Tibetan monks and that sort of thing. And I live in the wilderness here for Florida. I live in the last little area that's almost, it's not a city. You got to go 50 miles to buy a postcard kind of thing. And so I play this strange music when I play it, and the local guys come in and go, "What is that? What is that on the radio?" I said, "Well, that's kind of a new age music." "Well, why do you want to listen to that?" I said, "Because it makes you think." And they all go, "Well, why would you want to do that?" You know. So I'm kind of a loner in the shop. I teach when I'm teaching, I'm wide open with it, but it's very easy for me to do in groups and stuff. But when I'm focused on things like you're talking about making folders and that sort of thing, I have to be undisturbed. Same way when I'm writing, I write a lot. And if I'm disturbed, then my mind will go somewhere else and it will never go back to the spot I was in. It's very frustrating. So I just lock the doors kind of thing.
Yep.
But that's
sometimes
it.
Sometimes you need that patterns. Zen. Everybody's got their way of getting a Zen and you've got to protect that.
That's it. That's it. And I've been working on a lot of very, very difficult patterning, and I'm having great success with it. I tried some new techniques this afternoon. I had one piece that worked, and I had two that failed. But I'm playing with some friction welding, and it's you rub the steel together so fast that it sticks to itself.
And are you doing that in a lathe, or?
Yeah. A lathe, but it. It's a hit and miss deal. The problem is getting it stopped, because it'll actually shear in the chuck if you don't do it right. But I'm playing with that a little bit. And then I'm doing a lot of round patterns where I'm stacking patterns inside of patterns. And that's fun stuff.
I saw your jelly roll experimentation as well. The power jelly roll is pretty cool to watch.
Oh, you wouldn't believe this last one. I just reduced that again and stacked it inside some other material. It's going to be cool when it's done. Looks like an eyeball.
Yeah. So for the people who aren't as familiar with your work as they probably should be, how did you get your start in bladesmithing? Because you're the longest serving ABS member.
ABS Master Smith. I've been at it longer than anybody else. There's another guy that may be at the same time frame as me, and I think his name is Michael Walker. Not Michael Walker, but Michael. I can't even remember what his name is. That's what happens when you get to be 75 years old. But anyway, Michael Connor, and I don't even know if he's active or not. I hadn't heard from him in 20 years, but. As far as I know, I'm the longest serving, continuously serving ABS Master Smith. My rating was signed by Bill Moran in 1981, and I'm on the books in 83 because I was young like you guys once and very, very brash and opinionated, and it cost me because I ran my mouth at the wrong time and I regret it ever since, but it's done.
So, I mean, obviously getting on the books in 83, that journey must have started a long time before that. What got you into bladesmithing in the first place?
Well, when I forged a chisel when I was in middle school, I was probably 13, 14 years old in the class, and I think I might have got a C minus on it or something. Anyway, that was my first forging. And then I didn't do anything. And then out of high school, I went to work for an aircraft company, and I ran forging hammers and did sheet metal prefab. I was on the crew that built the first 747 vertical stabilizer that was ever built. I worked on Saturn rocket parts. I did a lot of stuff with metal in that time. And of course, we had access to stainless steel, and we didn't know what kind it was. So we ground out something that looked like a knife. So I call those knife-shaped objects. And this was in the 60s because we didn't know what it was. You know, we didn't know anything about heat treating. So they weren't knives. They were knife-shaped objects. And then I stopped again. And then in 1972, I got a job doing heavy rigging and welding. We were moving 500-ton loads and stuff like that into the power plants. And there was blacksmiths, iron ship fitters and boiler makers, and there were no blacksmiths left in the local. And so I was really interested in it. So I bought a book by Alex Beeler, and in that book is a page and a quarter, a page and a half on forging knives. I read that and it tripped a trigger in me that hadn't shut off since. And so I rushed out and bought me an anvil and a rivet forge. And, you know, people say you can't tear up an anvil. Well, you try cutting out, taking crosscut saw blades, heating them up in a rivet forge and cutting them out with a chisel on the face of your anvil and see what happens to it. You can destroy an anvil.
I'll do it.
Anyway, I was making these fillet knives for the phenomenal cost of $15 and $20 a piece. And the seal in those things is L6 or equivalent. And it's very easy to heat treat. And I got it right a lot. And I had a lot of friends of mine that were offshore fishing and that sort of thing. And they were flaying these big king mackerel and tuna and that sort of thing with them. And they thought they were wonderful. And they told me I was wonderful, so I believed them. Right up until the point that I found a real knife maker. It was a guy named Bobby Tyson. And I went up to him and asked him if, I said, do you make knives? And he was leaning up, we were on a construction job. He was leaning up against this big storage tank. He said, well, I try, a real humble guy. And he pulled out the most beautiful pocket knife I'd ever seen. You know, it walked and talked, and it had some mystery steel in it called D2. I didn't know what that was. Anyway, so he made a mistake of telling me he had books on knives. I said, where do you live? He said, well, Jacksonville, that's 2 hours from me. And I said, where in Jacksonville? And he made a mistake giving me a street address. I said, could I come to your shop? And he literally took me from where I was making rough knives with, you know, hammer handles for handles and that sort of thing. He took me 5 years ahead in a weekend because I took time to go study with the guy, and he was really good at what he does. And I never will forget him. His name's Bobby Tyson, and he really helped me a lot. He helped me start making folders a year or two after, and I made probably 20 before I had to sell them without a pair of pliers to open them. I didn't know how to set the springs, and people go, why are your springs so tight? And I said, well, they're manly knives.
Rip your thumbnail out trying to
pull the skin off your fingers, open them, but they didn't fold up on you too easy. But anyway,
wouldn't want to get your finger caught in there.
No, then I got into forging to start with, and then I wanted to learn. About 76 or maybe early 77, I got into pattern welding, and I was trying to do it on my own. And everything I made looked like a cabbage on a stick. It was just a bunch of leaves of sort of stuck together stuff. It was terrible. Anyway, so I heard about an old cowboy over in Williston, Florida, and the guy was a family horseshoer. I mean, they shoot these million-dollar racehorses and stuff. It's Al Pendray, who was really prominent in the Wootz industry. He and I worked together on that project for years. The first Witchblades are marked PJS as Pendray, Job, and Swarzer, and that was the three of us. But I went over there, and he was too busy to help me with the forge welding, so he put me off on his dad, and his dad showed me how to forge weld in about a half a day, and then I went home and went to work, and I started making crazy stuff. I was doing Merovingian stuff in the late 70s.
Yeah, well, that's it. You still are making crazy Damascus.
Well, that's the only thing I know how to do. I'm not even good at baskets.
At the bleeding edge of knife making technology.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
So we have a tradition on the show. We like to ask our guests about their anvil, and we know that most people who are quite serious about it have many anvils, but anyone who works with steel has that one special anvil, and they know which one it is, and we like to know the story of it and what the details of it are.
What you want to know about my anvils?
Mm.
All right. I've got two, and they're Fishers. They're 250 pounds a piece, and they're near mint. One of them was the first anvil I ever bought.
Still and got it?
I still have it. I bought the other one. It was actually, I traded a beat-up anvil for it because the guy caught his kids welding on top of it. And so he took it away from him, and he gave it to me, and I gave him the old beat-up one they could weld on or whatever they wanted to do. I still have those two. I've had many, many anvils in my life, but those two I keep. And one of them, they're both Fishers, but one of them is a Confederate anvil. These are Civil War era anvils, and they're mint. I mean, they're beautiful. Right. And one of them had the Federal Eagle on it, and the other one did not. They were made both ways. One was for the South, one for the North. And so I have them both, and they're both mounted on big, heavy roller stands so I can position them anywhere in the shop and then get them out of the way when I don't need them. They're all on rollers. And I love them. I've had some 400-pound anvils, 400-plus. I traded one out to Will Stelter that he did on his site. You can see it, you know, where he refinished the thing. That was a Soda Force. It was a 400-pound, 396 pounds. And then I gave Logan Gillihan about 360-pound American anvil, real nice forged anvil. But he helps me with all kinds of computer stuff. If I need computer stuff done, he's the guy that designed the controller for the coal iron press.
And that thing is
brilliant.
Nice. Yeah. Very tech-savvy guy.
Oh, he's sharp cookie, and a good guy too.
Ever since I saw that controller, I was really interested because, you know,
it's amazing. I've got one of two 50-ton presses they built, C-frames. They're going to make some more 50-tons, but they're not going to be C-frames. They're too expensive to produce. But I love that thing. That thing will go back to a hundredth of an inch. You can literally take a 1-inch square bar and make a 1-inch round rod out of it under that press. Because of the control.
That's amazing.
It really sort of marked a new era. We were talking about this, I can't remember if it was last episode or the one before, with sort of the innovations in forging as they as we move forward. And I still use a fly press, and Sam's got a hydraulic press, and then we were talking about moving forward. But we brought up those sort of infinitely adjustable, digitally controlled presses and what they're capable of. It's just incredible. And it kind of makes me wonder where the future's going with the precision that you can get in a home shop.
Oh, yes. It's good stuff. And, you know, I had people come to me, you know, and you hear this all the time. Well, you know, you've got a milling machine. You're not traditional. And I just laugh. I just laugh at that because I'm telling you, if they had, and they had stuff that they sufficed with back in the 1600s, 1700s, they had machinery. I mean, they forged huge ship shafts and all kinds of stuff. But I can make my hammer from dirt. I can literally take iron ore and reduce it and make my hammer. And then I can make all my tools. I can make my drill bits and I can make my files. I know how to do all this stuff and have done it. But it's you know, it's like, you tell me I'm not traditional. Tell me where.
Yeah, yeah. We often get that, and we say the same thing as, like, "Did you make your hammer? Did you make your drill pits? Did you make your bench? Your 2x72 grinder? Did you hand wire the motor?" And
yeah, that's it. Did you dig that copper ore up and then draw the wire?
Right. I mean, not all of us can be as patient as Wolfgang Lerchner and do everything with hand tools.
with files and sandpaper. He does CNC work with I've known Wolfie years. It's amazing stuff. Amazing stuff.
Oh yeah, we hope to get him on the show one time because he is the personification of patience, I think. That man to
and
be able to
do
what he does.
Is brilliant as well.
Yeah, Elizabeth is doing remarkable work.
Yeah.
Apple didn't fall far from the tree there, I don't think.
No, that's right. Jason's daughter can outforge him right now.
Yeah.
He's probably listening to this. He's going to kick my ass when I see him, but that's just another
We've been following Tiger Lily closely for a long time, and she's another one we hope to get on the show at some point. I often look to her for inspiration because I'm trying to chase consistency in my work, and she is just an absolute pinnacle of consistency with her work. It's incredible to watch.
Yeah, I watched her take a piece of that Hitachi white. It was about an inch diameter, about 4 inches long, and turn that into an integral with a butt cap in probably half an hour.
Wow.
By hand, no press.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. It made me want to go slip my wrists and hang in the closet, but I'll
maybe she could give you some classes, Steve.
Yeah.
I take a class from her and Jason every time I'm up there.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy their company. They've been friends. I've known Jason since he was 13 years old.
Yeah.
He used to write stories on knives when he was a young kid in high school and those stories were written about some old guy in Florida that makes knives. That was kind of interesting.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So we've actually had a few of your mates on the show. We've had Jaden Samisky and Jim Morrissey and Jason, and they all describe you as an absolutely sort of open book of learning and sharing knowledge and being unintimidating and warm and more. And there's sort of tenets that we try and share here on the ForgeCast. Would you want to tell us more about your personal philosophy as a maker that helps drive that sort of openness? I mean, you've been so present in the community for the existence of the community, basically.
Yeah, I was here pre-internet. That makes me a fossil. But I tell you, you learn things, and you come in and you're all excited. And I've seen it happen thousands of times with new makers. They're all excited, and they're just hell-bent for leather to get there. And then they try to take shortcuts and all kinds of stuff. And I try to talk to them about, you know, slowing down and breathing a little bit. And then they like anybody in that age group from 20 till about 40, when they get in the business, they want to be established as their own man. And that becomes a primary driver for them. Part of it has to do with the testosterone level. The other one is what they don't realize is the only competition you have as a maker is yourself. Doesn't matter what anybody else says. You're the only person on the planet that can make your knives. And there's no get-by factor in that, as far as I'm concerned. But what I try to do is tell them to achieve for themselves and try to improve, you know, try to constantly improve your work. I will take information from anywhere I can get it. The other thing I found is there's no time to do everything, and especially since I'm older. You look at something you want to study, and that's why I have students, and I've got literally 1,000 now. Over the years, I've taught people since I was your age or younger, and because there was no resource. And now you can learn anything on the internet. That's full of experts, and some of them actually are. Most of them are not. They think they know something, and they quote, "I have arrived. I did a TV show, so I have arrived. I'm the man."
Uh-huh.
And the thing is what happens is when you study, like I've studied, you suddenly realize that you really don't know much. And so you get full of ego from time to time. I did it. I'm guilty of it, but I got over it. I did a pattern one time that I built up an entire face, and I've got pictures of the thing I could show you sometime. I built up an entire face out of junk in my shop. I made the eyes and the beard and the hair and forged the teeth and put this whole thing together. And I made this face pattern, and it's I've got a bunch. There's some of it on my website, I think, with this pattern in it. And I showed this thing to a guy, and he took my idea and won a big national award with it in Europe. Didn't give me any credit with it at all. And so this is pre internet. So I sent him a fax. Have to have somebody explain what a fax is to you, but it's an old machine that you send messages on. We grew up with faxes. Well, this is better than a drum and a wet blanket and a fire. You weren't sending smoke signals, but it's close. And I said, I said something to him anyway. He sent me back 6 feet of denial. If I had kept my mouth shut and just let it go, I'd have been way better off, because he showed up with a knife some years later. And he still had it, and you couldn't tell what it was. It looked like a Rorschach test. And then you're looking at this thing, but he had a book that explained what it was. And the guy's a brilliant maker. He says, he's got plenty of his own ideas. He's a good guy. He's a good guy. But this particular thing hit me wrong. And I took this problem to a friend of mine, and he's an appellate attorney, one of the smartest guys I know. And he said, there's a poem by Rudyard Kipling that fits this. And I said, oh, yeah? He said, yeah.
If?
Yeah, by Rudyard Kipling. They said, it goes like this. They asked me how I did it. I gave them the scripture text. You keep your light a-burning, a little ahead of the next. They copied all they could follow, but they couldn't copy my mind. So I left them sweating and stealing a year and a half behind. And what it means is if you create, you always have ideas. If you copy, all you can ever do is follow. So you must create. And if you create, it doesn't matter what anybody else is doing. I've got students that run around me like I'm parked. I've got some of my students are the top makers on the planet. And it isn't what I taught them, it's what they did with the knowledge. And Antonio Fogarisu came to my shop in the 90s when he was a kid. His family had been making knives for 100 years. And he came to my shop, and I taught him how to pattern weld. Within 2 years, he had run around me like I was parked in quality and the stuff. And I was tickled to death about it. I'm not intimidated by that. I feed off of it. These young people are doing amazing things. I try to help them. It's just like this stuff we did with the printed 3D stuff. We developed that. I'm going back. As a matter of fact, I'm flying out Sunday to go back out there for another week-long class. And no telling what will come out of that, but it'll be good.
Somebody that we have had on the show a few times is another Mastersmith, Kyle Royer, and who is... it's easy to think of as one of the just peak of the craft, but I'm always very humbled talking to him. He's a hell of a guy to talk to, because he just everything about the way he talks, you can see he's in a state of learning. Somebody that so many people must look at his work and think it's just covered in perfection. But he himself is just perpetually just, what's the next thing I can learn? How can I refine this? How can I get it better? What can I do different next time? And it's the way we should all be. Yeah, they're incredible people. And it's hugely inspirational, because you do see some people sort of hit a point and think, this is it. I'm as good as I want to be, and I'm just going to sit here. I'm the best that I can be, sort of thing. But you can always be better. You can always improve. You can always refine. There's an old Norse saying that say you never lose. You win or you learn.
Right. Absolutely. And the thing is I always want them to come with an open mind. Jaden Szymanski came to my shop. It's hilarious. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he unfolds this mountain scene, And there's, it would have taken 12 canisters to make this thing. It had rivers and trees and mountains with snow on them and all that stuff. I'm looking at that one. Oh, man. Okay. I said, let me see if we can condense this thing. So we got it down to 3 4-inch square canisters. And we put that thing together, and it worked. There's probably pictures of it on his site, and that's where I know I've got.
Yeah, I think I've seen it. No,
on Instagram. Yeah, it was great. And my buddy Henning Wilkerson calls me up, and of course we talk probably 3 or 4 times a week, and he calls me up and he says, "Well, why didn't you put the guys on the horseback shooting goats and going up the side of the mountain?" I said, "Well, Henning, you didn't look close." Anyway, down at the bottom of one of those trees is a little guy sitting by a campfire in that thing. It was a total accident. It was a little blob of material. You know how you look at a cloud and see something?
Yeah.
Well, you look at this little blob of stuff, and it's a guy sitting by a campfire with the fire going, and it's unmistakable. You can look at it, and that's exactly what it appears. And so you had to look at it under magnification to see it. And I sent it to Henning. I said, "Well, why didn't you look for the guy with the campfire?" And I blew it up real big, and I sent it to him. Anyway, it was fun stuff.
I mean, you're kind of known and have been known for a long time for your Damascus work and pattern welding work and canister work. Do you have a favorite style that keeps drawing you back?
I like things that are precise. I don't like random things. I like stuff that I control. And learning how to do precision welding and control it without destroying the image is what I've basically focused on. Now, there's places for chaos. And some of the chaotic stuff like the crushed W's has been done everywhere in the world. But some of the guys are starting to manipulate the color gradients in those and getting this outstanding. You got these bright areas and the very dark areas. Stuff looks like snowflakes, but it looks like snowflakes that were organized by somebody. It's a beautiful stuff. I'm not knocking it. It's just, that's not me. I want an image. I want to make something cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like the challenges that surround, stuff like your canister work, especially given recently your work with 3D printed, you know, canister Damascus, and trying to maintain the shape of the, you know, whatever object is in there, whether it be a dinosaur or a horse or anything like that. I my mind bends a little bit trying to maintain that shape. anyone who's forged knows that, you know, like a half a degree angle difference in your hammer or, you know, anything like that can squish a billet way out of whack. So it's always really impressive to see that.
Well, that shooting scene that I did back in 90 with the shooter with the birds and all that stuff, that thing took me literally months to build. But that all started, I went up, I don't know if you guys remember Darryl Meyer or know who he is. He was the genius behind most modern mosaic back in the 70s. He had a big research group up at Carbondale, Illinois. And it was him and I think Jim Wallace and I think Bill Farini was involved. I forget who all was there, but Darryl Meyer was the force behind that. And I was a student of his, and I still consider myself a student of his. The guy is brilliant. He doesn't do much with the stuff now. Of course, he's older than I am, and that's not many of my friends left that are. But anyway, Darryl was doing this stuff, and I went up to his shop, and I walked by a barrel in his shop, and I looked down in there, and there was a set of squaring dies on a hairpin mount, you know, where they clap together. I looked in there, and I picked that up, and I showed it to Darryl, and I said, "What is that?" And he said, "Oh, that's nothing." And I threw it back in the barrel. And then when I went by again, there was a rag thrown over it. And I went, "Ooh, okay." That was the key to that shooting scene, is getting the energy in four directions. Now, what all the stuff does, and not to get too long-winded about it, the whole idea of doing what we were doing, manipulating these patterns, was to get away from very expensive high-tech machining to get the images. See, that shooting scene was EDM'd, but it had to be reduced. That guy was, I don't know, I don't do centimeters and meters and that kind of stuff, but the guy was about an inch and a half long, about half as long as your thumb when he started off. And I reduced that thing down to the height just under the width of your fingernail in that blade without distorting it. And I made a set of those squaring dies, and I would forge a while, and then I would cut the billet open and look at it to make sure that I wasn't. And so I learned how to do percentages in the billet in order to control that, not to get too technical about it. But that was, that whole thing came about because I was doing Merovingian patterns and all kinds of stuff. And I saw Daryl, and he said, why don't you make something real? So I did. And I made that shooting scene, and I showed it to him. And I still get choked up about it. I'll try to get it out without weeping on the podcast. But he said, sometimes the student exceeds the master. It's probably the best compliment I've ever been paid in my knife making career to come from him.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for all he shared with me years later. I mean, I can't say enough. But
just goes to show the importance of that sharing of information. It's how we grow.
I get to jabbering. Anyway, I take information from anywhere. And
it's so funny. I'll give you a quick story and then I'll shut up for a little bit.
I had a student come, and this guy's name, Caleb Budd. I'm going to call him out by name. He's a knife maker and he's doing well. But he showed up at my gate early one morning. He's supposed to be there at like 8:30, and I opened the gate and there's this young man standing there, and he looked like a Mormon missionary. He's standing there all nice and clean and standing at the gate, and there's no car. And I live in the woods. I mean, you don't get there by accident. I live at the end of, I'm on the end of a dead end road. There's a few houses down here, but this, and I looked at him and I said, how'd you get here? And he said, oh, my mom dropped me off. And I'm like, oh man, okay, here we go. And anyway, so went in and we start working. I said, well, what do you want to do, Caleb? And he said, well, I want to see about pattern weld steel. I want to make some W's. And I said, okay. So we stacked it all up, and I always started the things in a vertical plane. I would start knocking those down to start forming the C's and the S's in there. And he said, in a set of squaring dies, I used squaring dies to start them. He said, well, why don't you turn it halfway and just turn it up where that's flat in there? I said, I don't know. And I did. And it worked beautiful. So I call it my Caleb Budd method. You know, it didn't make me any smaller to give him credit for the idea. And he'd never made a knife at that point, I don't think. Or he just started. But I mean, I will take information from where I can get it. It's I love hanging out with these young geniuses because they're full of ideas and they're just full of fire. The problem is they can work 10, 12 hour days, and by the end of the day, they're calling my bluff pretty good.
Well, it's a bit like what you were saying about, you know, digging dirt to make a hammer and things like that. Ideas are the same just by the act of forging at all in the last 100 years. We are, everything we do is on the shoulders of giants. We're adding on to a craft that has been around for centuries, and you really, I mean, you're gonna start having to credit the person who invented scrolling and things or something. You know, it's, forging techniques has been passed from person to person for centuries, and I see no reason to stop it now.
No. You got to be careful. I've learned some lessons later in my career, and it's one of the things is we're all working in the same medium. You're in Tasmania, and I'm here, and then and I was writing an article on mosaic stuff, and I figured out how to do tiling way back. And I was doing that in the 80s, and I've got pictures of the stuff. And I was doing center cores, and I was tiling and then forge welding that all together, and then mostly in pocket knives, but I did it in some big blades as well. And I thought that I had come up with that. And later on, there was a guy credited with it that made his first knife in 1995. Anyway, I was writing an article about it. That was a sore spot with me for a while, but I got over it. I got older and wiser. And anyway, so I'm looking at that, and I consulted a friend of mine that's a very, very bright young guy that does a lot of ancient archaeological research on metals and stuff. And I said, I'm writing an article about this, and I want to talk about this tiling. He said, I've got something you need to read before you publish. And I went, okay. So he sent me this pamphlet, and it was about a Javanese bladesmith. And the guy died in 1992. And he was one of those mystic Muslim bladesmiths that did all the magic stuff with the krisses. But in that pamphlet about him was that exact method, not something similar. It was exactly that tiling method. Mm. And I'm looking at that and I'm going, did he learn that himself? Did he learn that from his dad? Or did it come down from generations? And so I had to rethink my whole philosophy. What that is a solution to a problem. And we're working in the same material. So that solution is just as valid in Java as it is here or Tasmania or anywhere else. And so you may have an idea. There's no reason that solution can't nuclei anywhere on the planet.
It's like how calculus was invented by two different people only a few years apart on opposite sides of the globe.
Exactly.
They just coincidentally had come up with the solution to a problem that had existed for a long time, and they both needed to find the solution but didn't realize the other person was doing the exact same thing.
Exactly. And then it comes back to what we started with. You're the only person on the planet that can do your work. Just do it.
Yeah.
And that's something that, like, Alex and I have admired in you, and people like yourself who are just very open and sharing with everything you come across. Every new process that you've come across, it's like instantaneously, the moment you've discovered it.
The canister is a perfect example of that 3D printed canister.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just, Alex and I try and like share as much as we can whenever we discover something new. We like to get it out there because, like, as much as it's not just like, you know, we want to share the methods and stuff, it's that people can build on a method really quickly. Mm. As one person, you can develop a technique, you know, whatever technique it might be. But if you keep it to yourself, you're only going to be developing that technique in a vacuum under, you know, with one perspective. Whereas when you share it with the wider community, people can take that and run with it and, you know, turn it into something way bigger and better than
like,
you
thought. It's like planting a seed. It will grow into all manner of different types of things.
I do a lot of things. I've done several things at very, very high levels. And one of them is I took my first martial arts lesson in 1962. And I wasn't good at it, but I was like my instructors always say, what he lacks in skill, he makes up for with enthusiasm.
Yep.
And so he did that. And then when I was 62, I met a guy and then my shoulders were killing me and I was trying to do some stuff to straighten my shoulders out. And he started coaching me and I set 8 world records bench pressing after I was 60 years old. And most people are not aware of it, but I still hold world records. They're still on the books, AAU world records and bench press. And it comes down to setting your mind to a goal and then going for it. That's what you want to do. I would go to weight meet sometime and there'd be nobody in my age group but me. I'm not there to compete against anybody. I was after that record. That's what I was after, the record. And it's the same way with any of my other skill sets that I do. Is I don't do anything a little bit. Hell, I've raced airboats and done all kinds of stuff. But at this stage of the game, I don't heal up as much. But as far as the knife end, I'm driven by these young guys, the stuff they're doing. I share with them wide open. If I come to you and I share a technique with you, when you discover something new, who's the first person you're going to call?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's self-serving, yeah, but it works.
Egoistic altruism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So, Steve, we, being an educationally themed show, we do let our listeners email us in questions. And we have a segment on each episode where we read out the questions and then answer them. We'd love it if you could help us answer a few.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, just to let everyone know, our listener email segment comes to you thanks to the Knife Maker Plus program. So get taught the art of bladesmithing one-on-one by ABS Master Smith Kyle Royer. It's like he's right there in the room with you instructing you. Plus, you get to pause him and rewind him as much as you'd like to turn your knife making game all the way up to 11. Visit learnknifemaking.com after the show to enter the next level. And our first email comes from Mitchell, and he says, "Hello, gents. I'm Mitchell Coy. I have been wanting to get into blacksmithing and bladesmithing for some time now, and I finally have a space available to work from. I have been accruing tools and equipment for a little while now. My father has an anvil that has been passed down through the family. I have several hammers that should work decently with minimal modifications and a set of basic tongs. The last part of the puzzle is the forge. Initially, I was going to get a Hell's 2 burner forge to get started. However, my father-in-law gave me a bunch of extra fire brick that he used to make a pizza oven with. I have verified that these are hard fire bricks, and I am now in the thoughts of making the forge. On YouTube and other sites, I have seen fire brick forges working decently as is and seems quite simple to make. But my main question is, would it be worth lining the fire brick with kale wool or equivalent and then coating that with refractory cement? My assumption being that would make the forge get up to higher temps and run more efficiently with propane in general, even when those higher temps aren't needed. I am eager to see what your thoughts are on this and if you have any more specific advice. Looking forward to hearing from you, gentlemen. Thank you, Mitchell." Welcome to the craft, Mitchell.
Yeah, thanks, Mitchell. Yeah, welcome. Depending
on the grade of the fire brick, it should have, it could potentially have enough thermal mass to be able to hold temperature really well. Essential Craftsman on YouTube has a really good video showing building a simple fire brick forge. But adding thermal mass, which is what you'd be doing by adding the isowool and refractory, will let it hold temperature easier. Which means it'll take longer to get up to temperature because it's going to heat all that mass. But once it's there, it'll hold it a lot better. I'm not sure whether or not it'll help you reach higher temperatures, but once you're up to temperature, you might actually be able to lower your gas pressure and be able to keep forging and make that gas battle last longer.
You want me to jump in?
Yeah.
I've literally built probably at this stage of the game over 100 forges. I started off I had a Pendray forge, and those things, you got one, it still exists intact, but it was castable refractory, and a lot of it, we used rammable stuff in it. Took all day to get it hot enough to forge well, but then it would stay hot for 3 days after you shut it off. What he's doing with that fire brick, if he lines that with kale wool, then he's basically building a shell out of the hard brick. If you've got 2 inches of kale wool, that heat's going to be contained in there. It's going to be about 10 times as efficient as if he's trying to use that brick. If you're trying to heat that brick, you're burning all that gas up trying to get that brick hot. Well, the kale wool, see, that came out of the space shuttle. That's where that stuff was developed. You can put 2700F on the outside of that and put your hand on the other side. And it works. Yeah, it'll work fine for it. A lot of people use the soft brick, but I like the hard bricks in the bottom or a piece of kiln plate. So the flux, if you use flux, it won't eat it.
Yeah.
It works great. Yeah. If he wants to build like that, it'll work fine. And then you just brick the door up.
That's what I was thinking of, that extra, like the porosity of the kale wool giving it that, kind of lower density inside the forge is going to mean that it heats up a little quicker than straight to the brick.
Oh, the other thing is, if you
a lot quicker.
if you build the forge yourself, one thing that we always espouse on this show is understanding the why behind things. And if you just go and buy a pre-built forge and use it, you'll never really understand why the forge does the things that it does. Whereas if you've built it yourself, you'll have a much deeper understanding of it. It'll make you a more well-rounded maker, to be honest.
Yep.
Help
yeah,
you build future too. Forges.
That,
yeah. So hopefully that helps you, Mitchell.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
The other thing is I always like a positive pressure blower on my forges. I don't like Venturi forges. Some of them are very efficient and they work, but they're affected by barometric pressure and the weather. Mm. If you got a little positive pressure blower on it, it makes everything different. And the other thing that I do on all of my forges is I put a needle valve and I use a quarter inch pipe. I don't know what that is in centimeters.
Quarter inch is anyway, about 6 mil.
It's about the size of a pencil and I've got a needle valve on it. I don't use a ball valve. I use a needle valve. And that way you can precisely control the gas flow. You can never get it right with a ball valve except by accident. You need a needle valve. And they're common and they use them in plumbing for like ice makers and stuff on your fridge at home. You turn the water up, pressure up and down with that little needle valve. Those needle valves work great for gas, propane.
And also, if you have the air blower in, mixed with the gas, you'll use a lot less gas than you will using something like a Venturi burner.
Venturi burners are all Bernoulli effect. So you have to have the gas flow in order to draw the air. Mm. Now, you can change the orifice size and increase the velocity of the gas, which will get you a good draft, but you're limited with what you can do with them. And that's why if you've got a forge that welds, they generally have three or four of those things running. Where if you got a little tiny blower motor and a piece of inch and a half pipe that's necked down just a little bit when it goes in, you melt steel with the thing.
Yeah, we will of course say though, if you are thinking of building your own burner and you're a beginner, that is, it can be quite dangerous. So just be careful. Just official ForgeCast statement: be careful.
Yes.
So our next email comes from Tommy, and he says, "Hey guys, listening to you talk to Tobias again has gotten my head buzzing. Boy, that guy is smart as hell." It made me go back and re-listen to the last episode he was on as well. And one comment he made, though, was how 15 and 20 is not a very good knife steel. And I had some thoughts on that. In earlier episodes, you described 15 and 20 as being, and I'm paraphrasing here, basically just 1084 with nickel powder added in. This made me confused, as you've said that 1084 is great for knives. The other thing I thought, though, when you were discussing alternatives to 15 and 20 for light contrast in Damascus, could L6 work? I seem to recall you guys mention it a long time ago. It'd be a couple of years back now as a potential light contrast steel for making scrap Damascus. Anyway, love the show. Long time fan. Keep on rocking. Tommy. All right. It's an interesting question. So I'll let you go, Sam. You're the metallurgical guy.
Well, I don't know. We've got Steve Schwarzer on the show.
We do have Steve Schwarzer sitting there.
But the thing about what Tobias was saying about 15 and 20 not being a great knife steel, you've got to understand the context in which he's saying that, right? Like Tobias is one of the designers and one of the key makers of Apex Ultra, which is probably one of the best knife steels on the market when it comes to forgeable knife steels. He is looking towards super steels as far as, you know, his quality of knife steel, right? When you're thinking quality knife steel, when we're talking about Tobias, we're talking about super steels. Yeah. 15 and 20 is a serviceable knife steel in the, you know, simple carbon kind of range with the added nickel. I believe most 15 and 20 is about 0.7 to 0.75% carbon. So that's about 1075, 1070, which is a usable knife steel, but it's not going to perform at the same level as Apex Ultra, CPM MagnaCut, you know, any of those super steels that we're talking about. While he's correct that it's not a great knife steel in context of the various super steels we now have an access to, it is still a serviceable knife steel.
The other thing I'd like to point out, I'm not sure what the actual metallurgical science of it is, but taking something like 1075 and adding nickel powder doesn't mean that you're going to have a steel that has the properties of 1075 plus the added light etching function. The presence of nickel in the mix is going to affect the potential hardenability and toughness of a steel. It's changing the composition of the steel, so it doesn't mean that it's going to perform the same way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as far as L6 goes, I have not used L6 in a Damascus, but I have seen it used by Mr. Kevin Cashin. But I'd like to pass this over to Steve. What's your opinion on that L6 there, for light?
I'd have to get my book out to show you the difference in the chemistry, but they're almost identical. And L6 cuts like crazy when you heat treat it right, and so does the 15N20. But when you're comparing it, it's apples and oranges when you're comparing it to the super seals that are designed to produce that ultra-fine carbide. And the carbide's what makes it cut. And so if you get the heat treat spot on and you're not doing guessing, by gosh, oh, that's hot, stick it in some old motor oil and then we'll wave it around in a torch until it looks like it won't break. Well, then, you know, if you get lucky, you do good. And the thing is you need to take time to learn your materials. I will not use unknown material for any reason. And I'll tell you why. It introduces a term called total imponderability to your work. Even if you get a good result, you cannot repeat it when that supply runs out because you don't know what you have. I'll give you a fun, you want a funny story to go with that?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Go for it.
All right. I went to a knife show one time. This is back when I was younger and I was in the cups a little bit. I'd had a few drinks and there was a little guy that always hung around the hammerings and stuff. His name was Charlie Hoyle. I don't even know if he's still alive or not, but he was a little character, a little Walter Mitty guy. And he'd come up to me and he was going, I want you to, he had a very distinctive voice. He said, I want you to build me a knife. And I said, okay, what do you want, Charlie? He said, what can I get for $150? I said, a rivet. And that's what you get. Anyway, so he stayed after me about that thing. And I'd had a few more drinks and said, okay, I'll build you a knife. Well, that went on for 2 years. I didn't build the knife, and I'd see him, and I got to where I was dodging this guy, and I'd see him coming, and I'd like step off, so I didn't have to listen to the questions about this $150 knife. And he called me at my shop, and he says, "This is Charlie Hoyle. You gonna make my knife or not?" And I went, "Okay, I'm gonna make it." And I thought, "Damn it!" And anyway, I went out in my scrap pile, and I saw a piece of a leaf spring there, and I grabbed that thing up, and I ran in there. And I beat out a Scramus axe under my big power hammer, slapped some handles on it. I had about 3.5 hours in that knife, so you can imagine what it looked like. And anyway, so I heated it up red hot, slapped it into motor oil, and waved a torch over it, and threw it in a box and shipped it to him. And I had a sinking feeling in my gut when I did it. I should have known better. I shipped him this knife. 2 weeks later, he calls me. He says, "This is Charlie Hoyle," and I almost threw up. He says, "I want to talk to you about my knife." I'm going, in my head, I immediately said, "I'm making a $150 knife again for free." That's what I was thinking. He says, "I don't know what you made this out of, but I cut up a cord of rock maple with it, and it'll still shave." I went, "Oh my God, what was it made out of?" So I ran out there and I got a piece of the spring, and I sent it off to a friend of mine that had a lab, and he did the whole test on it. It was 5160.
Yeah. And
it barely hardens, but by just sheer accident, I got it right. Just absolute accident. It wasn't my fault the knife was good. Let me put it that way. I learned a lesson from it, and that's why I don't use stuff I don't know what it is ever. Even if it's free, I won't use it.
Even though it was a good result, you probably went through enough stress for three lifetimes during that phone call.
I was like, no, I ain't doing that again.
So on the second part of the question, which is L6 in place of 15N20 in Damascus for the light steel, what's your experience with that, Steve? Have you tried L6 as a light Yeah?
Yeah, I've used it. It's great. Anything with nickel in it does that. You got to be careful with nickel, though. If you look up my shooting scene, that knife that's published with that shooting scene in it, you'll see a bright halo around that shooting scene. Mm. And what happened is if 2% or 3% nickel's good, 9%'s got to be really better. Okay? That was my thinking. So yeah. I get a hold of a company in Atlanta. I'm not Atlanta, in Houston. And I got some special steel they had that was iron, basically a 9% nickel, because I wanted it bright. But I've been using 203E, which is about 3%, 2.5% to 3% nickel and iron. And it was beautiful. That's what Jim Schmidt, all the early makers used it for color. Didn't have any carbon in it, but we layered it up with enough high carbon to make it cut. Anyway, so I bought this stuff, and then I did that whole shooting scene. I've inlaid that shooting scene, months of work, in that block. And then I was going to EDM off slabs to make folders out of. Well, when I heat treated that block, that 9% nickel went, screw you, I'm not moving. And all the high carbon, it shattered at every weld line with that image in it.
Oof.
Wow.
And I'm like totally collapsed now mentally, because I've got all this time in it. We had to take that thing and grind that block and etch it and put it in an optical comparator and map that thing, and then cut that back out with a wire machine and put it in another block and re-weld it. And that's where a little bit of knowledge will make you nervous, but I pulled that off and I got 4 knives out of that thing. And but you talk about stress you out. I mean, it pushed my skill sets to the absolute limit, because not only have I made this thing, I had to reduce the guy down, match the dog to the guy. Then I had to make all the birds. If you'll look at that picture under any kind of magnification, you'll see halos around every one of those birds. Those birds were 3/4 inch from wingtip to wingtip, and they have flight feathers on the ends of their fingers, on the ends of their wings. And now that rod came down, it was 1/4 inch square. Each one of them was 1/4 inch square with that bird in the middle of it. Now I had to turn those around and fit them in a block where I wanted the birds flying, weld that, and then match that to this, and then reduce the whole mess down to fit in those blades. And then I blew it up, and then I had to fix the blow up. So that's stressful. Yes.
I reckon you could crack macadamia nuts between your butt cheeks during that whole experience.
Very, very easily. Turn them into paste. Yeah. But it's one of those things, it'll push you. It's
I reckon.
The difference between a German and a master is the size of the screw up you can fix.
Yes. Our next email is like you're on the show, Steve. It's very poignant to your work. It says, "G'day, Forgecast. I know Alex loves his non-ferrous laminates, but with the recent developments in 3D printed canister Damascus, could you put, say, powdered copper in some of the segments to basically program custom QMI billets?" And that's from Broden. That's a good question. Have you tried that, Steve, with your 3D?
It's been done. But I'm gonna voice my opinion on it. You will never find a copper pan in a kitchen that's not tinned, and the reason for that is copper is toxic.
Yeah.
So they're making all these knives, and plus you're setting up a galvanic reaction. That knife will eat itself over time. And I'm not knocking it; it's beautiful work, but basically it's high temperature soldering. Yes, you can set it up in that pattern and do it, and it'll be beautiful for a while. But if you don't maintain it, it'll eat itself. It's like putting pennies in the bottom of your aluminum John boat and going saltwater fishing. Pretty soon, the pennies burn through the boat, and there you are, sunk. It's all galvanic action. You know, I'm not knocking anybody does it. It's beautiful stuff. I've seen guys do it with brass and gold and everything else, but it's a maintenance nightmare. It's not my flavor of tapioca, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Fair. But in terms of metallurgy, you reckon that powdered non-ferrous metals in a canister setup would weld just fine?
If the temperatures are compatible. But the problem with those things is generally those all go liquid far before the steel gets there. The other problem with using powders is your sintering. You would almost have to make the steel and then add the powder to do it. Your sintering, and it takes a long time. See, that the thermal conductivity of the powder is probably almost half of what solid steel is. And the other thing is, true. Is when you do those powdered segments, if you're mixing powdered solids, one of the things you'll find out is that powder has to be reduced by 30% to be a solid, no matter how tight you pack it. Mm. In order to get that interstice out of it, you've got to reduce it by 30%. So you have to allow
for a lot of planning.
Yeah, you have to. That guy that invented calculus needs to be your friend. Some of that stuff can be done, but it's like, why? That's what I'm looking at it. You know, nobody else has done it, but yeah, you can pull off some strange things. You know, it's like welding titanium. I taught a class up in Minnesota, and I got a friend of mine that Peter Martin. He's just really good with it. I said, I want to watch you weld. And he actually welded a piece in front of me. I want to see it. I've been playing with it for a while and having intermittent results. And I wanted to get better at it. So I went to a guy that's having success. And there was absolutely no mystery to it. It was just like, I'm using two pieces of bed rail and I'm stacking it in here and I squeeze it. And it does that. And I'm thinking, yeah, right. He's got some kind of hookup on it. Anyway, he did it in front of me. And then I went home and I went, okay, I'm overthinking this stuff again. I'm really overthinking it. The secret to any forge welding is keeping the air off. Keep the oxygen out and it'll hold hands. I was welding stuff in my lathe today with no outside heat source other than friction.
Friction, yeah.
Yep.
Friction welding. It's always great to watch. Great to watch.
It's fun stuff.
Well, we got one last email, and it's from Andrew, and he says, hi, guys. I have a question about selling items online. I'm yet to set up my website and web store. I remember Alex saying he has left Etsy, and I have heard that they take a lot of your profit from each sale. Very true. With my day job at its peak, I end up working 60-plus hours a week and really can't make it to markets around me, not that there are many anyway. I make a range of items from hooks, metal flowers to blades. So the question I have is, where is a good place that is online to sell my items? Thanks for all that you guys do for the community and the mountains of information. Sorry for the long question. And FYI, I live in Melbourne, if that helps. Andrew. Thanks, Andrew. So it's sort of, as most of the listeners know, before I was a bladesmith, I was a business guy. I help people build businesses. And one of the biggest mistakes I kept seeing over and over and over again is people having an attitude of, if you build it, they will come. You know, you just set up an online presence and everyone will just manage to magically find you. Little elves will guide them towards your store, and that's that. But it's footwork. Just like going to markets and setting up stalls is footwork, having an online presence where you can sell your work, it takes footwork to get people aware of your store, get people directed to your store, and mostly get people wanting to see your store. And as much as I hate social media, I hate it with a passion. It is the way to reach a lot of people that is free and doable from your couch, your bed, the toilet, anything. You can spend any spare time you've got doing work on social media to direct people to an online store. I agree with not using Etsy, along with a lot of makers that have sort of turned against Etsy after their recent changes to their user agreement, where they're taking up to 40-45% of each sale sometimes for no return. They haven't changed anything in their system to make the platform better. So a lot of people are moving to building online stores using things like Wix or Shopify or what have you. But if you do that, it's great. It's a wonderful way to set up an online presence and make you independent, but you have to actually do the work to get people to find your web store. People aren't just going to happen across it. You need to market yourself, right? So learn up on marketing, study marketing. There's a lot of, as we were talking about, with blacksmithing and bladesmithing techniques, we live in the world of the internet, and you can learn anything you want by looking around and watching YouTube videos and reading articles and things. Marketing is going to be your friend, because no matter how good your web store is, no matter how good your product is, reputation and word of mouth is only going to get you so far. You really need to actually do footwork to get people to find your work, unless you're as famous as Steve Schwarzer, and then people
out. People will hunt you down at home.
They will look for you.
Your work has to be good, but you also have to have the whole key to selling any of this stuff is having a story. There was a guy when we were coming up and trying to make a name for ourselves early on in the 80s. There was a guy in California named Phil Hartsfield. And Phil was out in Hollywood. And he would take a bar of A2 and do a one-sided chisel grind on it. And put the Americanized Japanese tip on the thing, wrap it with paracord, and dip it in epoxy, and people were lined up physically fighting over them for $8,000 a piece because he had some Japanese movie star chop one of those soft iron helmets in two with one of them. And it was on the cover of Blade magazine. And so he that was the thing. If you got the cover of Blade magazine, that was like being on Joe Rogan back in the day. You know, if you got the cover of Blade magazine, you were set. Well, he did that. And we, of course, all we were doing like really nice work and stuff. And you lucky if you got $300 or $400 a piece for him. But the side story is back in those days, if you went into a knife show, there would be 300 tables here, big show in the state, 300 tables. On 100 of those tables, there would be people making Bob Loveless drop point skinners. Bob Loveless was a legend. Okay. The guys that were new, they were getting anywhere from $150 to $200 a piece for it. And the guys that were older and had done some time and were doing really good work were getting $300 or $400 a piece. And some guy occasionally get $700 or $800 for one because he was like the top of the copiers. And there's old Bob Loveless with a cigarette sitting back there with a glass of whiskey getting $2,300 a piece for the same $150 knife because he was Bob Loveless.
Yeah.
It's about the story. You have to have, there has to be something in your personality. If you don't have a personality, you hire one. That's why they have dealers, you know. And that's absolutely the truth. That's the truth of it. It's like my friend, I love him to death. He's like family. He's Neil Kamimura. He's been making knives about 5 years.
Great guy.
Sells out in 12 minutes. He's a genius. He's a marketing genius. And he just absolutely is as good as it gets at marketing. But his work is also good. The work carries itself. And he's not afraid to step out. He'll try stuff. You see that new pattern that he Mariko showed him how to stick it together, but he stuck the damn thing together. It's beautiful. The stuff is outstanding. I went over to visit him, and he's got a little small shop. It just happens to be on the side of a volcano, and you can reach out the window and pick a banana if you want it, that kind of thing. But it's like I said, he's got a brilliant mind, and he's made himself. He's self-made. He did that himself. It had nothing to do with the little foray on the television show. It had to do with marketing. He knows marketing. He's as good as it gets at that.
Yeah, we've reached out to him to try and get him on the show, but he's a hard man to pin down because of that popularity. And it's well deserved. I mean, he's done such good work, been such a face for the industry the last couple of years.
It's amazing. He's got some television stuff coming out, and he's doing it. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's fixing to hit on him, but he's as good as it gets.
Yeah, yeah.
High praise coming from you.
It is. I was just thinking.
Well, I had him in my shop for 10 days. I just wanted to keep him. he came in my shop. He says, I want to make a million layer blade, and I don't want to cut it and stack it. I want to fold it up. I want to just keep folding it. Well, when you do that process, it develops hundreds of blisters in there. It's like folding up decals. And so I showed him how to get all the blisters out. And that's one of the things that I specialize in is repairing flaws. I know how to do that because my living depended on learning how to develop those techniques. So we made a million layer blade and it cut like crazy. But that's what he wanted to do. So we made it happen. It, so it was like Jane came and then my buddy up in Tennessee, he shows up down there and he goes, I said, what do you want to do? And he pulls out the primrose tiling pattern.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I said, how many days do you have? He said, oh, I just need today. We started cutting stuff. We started cutting stock at 8:30 in the morning. 4:30 in the afternoon, all the pieces were cut and ground and stacked, and we welded it. And he put it together. Nice. But he's sharp cooking, too. Yeah. They show up with these.
That actually... It actually leads me to the last question that I wanted to ask you for the episode, Steve. You have been an inspiration to a lot of people because you've been around for so long and you've seen the industry change, you've seen the community change, you've seen techniques change. Who has been a major influence on you and your work?
Oh, early on, it was Daryl Meyer, Jim Schmidt, Don Fogg and Jimmy Fikes. They were the elder statesmen, the spirit guides. For me, anybody that does a cutting test today owes that to Jimmy Fikes. He's the one that developed all that up in Ashokan and all. Of course, you know, any kind of organization early on, you know, there's always people that agree and disagree, whatever. That's neither here nor there. But Jimmy went off on his own, but he was a genius that was behind the cutting stuff. And that was one of the things he put in me was, no matter how fancy my knife is, it has to cut. It has to be a tool first. I've never made a knife that wouldn't cut. I won't do it because I don't want that thing coming up in a yard sale and having it pop off in somebody's hand like an old carrot. You know, I want that thing to cut and do what it's supposed to. I don't care how pretty it is. And that's one of the things. And then I guess... it's people that were developing and designing stuff. It's like Antonio Fogarizzo. He influenced me, even though I was teaching him in the 90s. The work he's doing now, is he's probably as good as there is in that high art stuff. I couldn't do that work. It's because I couldn't do it. I could probably do it, but I wouldn't enjoy doing it. And I don't do anything I don't like. If I don't like it, it ain't happening. And the other thing that I have is I'm influenced. If I go to somebody's shop and they're doing something cool, I will retool my shop. That's my wife. I've got $500,000 worth of stuff that makes knives out there, and I don't use about a tenth of them. But I think probably... Bobby Tyson, the guy that really helped me out early on. But there's so many new makers. You know, it's like Jason. I learned so much from being around Jason. I went up and did that Ford series with him up there. We did all that filming and stuff. But he is a genius with the art and design. I mean, he knows how to design knives. He's been a big influence on me. The folder makers, Tommy Overridner out in Texas has always been somebody I kind of follow. Johnny Stout, he's down in New Braunfels, Texas. I did a folder class with him about 4 or 5 years ago just to tune myself up. I make a folder, it just takes me forever. And he can do one pretty quick. So those people, I mean, and all the new students, Jaden and all those guys, they all influenced me. But what Will Stelter and I, we did the dinosaur knife, and then we made it a straight razor. Will and I do a lot of stuff. And the newest guys that are really pushing me are Salem Straub and I just had one of those brain skips. This is prevalent at 75 years old. But, and then Mariko Malmasi, he drives me with his pattern stuff. And Henning Wilkerson. I mean, I went to South Africa to watch him work. He thought he was having me come over to teach him a class. I was coming over there to steal everything that was in his mind. And there was a lot in there. I learned more from him than I have from almost anybody in recent time, because he thinks in 3D. He's a master craftsman. He came out of the gun industry. He can fit wood and steel together better than anybody I know. And he's truly a decent human being. I think Henning has probably been one of the biggest influences. And, of course, Neil Kammermuir. And Neil's marketing is what drives me and his skill sets. He's fast. He's like a machine. His arm, he looks like a fiddler crab. He's got one arm twice the size. He looks like an arm wrestler champion. You know, he hand hammers like crazy. I hope his arm doesn't fall off one day. But I learned a lot from Neil about marketing, you know. And then, of course, in the scientific end, we have Logan out there at Coal Iron. The whole Coal Iron bunch. I love being around those guys because they're always thinking and developing new stuff, tooling, all kinds of tooling. You know, I enjoy that. And, of course, Ron Hardman and I worked on that 3D printed stuff together. And he had like 16,000 students through his school last year. And we worked on that 3D printed thing together. He's a neat guy. He's got a great school out there. That's where I'm going next week. I'm going to be out there teaching for him.
Very cool.
Those are the guys that are kind of adding to everything. I should have made a list.
Awesome.
Of course, my wife. I couldn't do anything without my wife. She feeds me. But Laura's actually a very good bladesmith too. And she keeps me centered. And I have to give her a lot of credit. Because she takes care of everything for me, so I don't have to deal with much of anything as far as paying bills and that sort of thing. Plus, she's a great bladesmith. So I guess that, you know, that's not it, but that's all I can come up with on a moment's notice.
Yeah. I mean, that's. I think the message is there, though, to you know, kind of like reiterating what we were talking about earlier with just looking around you and seeing what people are doing and taking it in and progressing it and advancing it. You're just going to start seeing more and more. If you're open to seeing, you're going to see more and more people that are just doing the most incredibly amazing work. I mean, Sam and I are discovering new people all the time that have been doing the most incredible things that just blow our minds. And it's important to see what other people are doing because it's giving them the recognition they deserve for the hard work and hours that they've put in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Niels is another example of a guy that's just brilliant with his stuff.
Yeah.
And then John Horrigan out in Texas, he probably does the best embellishment that I've seen in a long time. He does inlay and gold inlay and pearl and stuff like that. And to me, that's witchcraft. I look at that.
Yes.
How do you do that? But that, there's a, like I said, the list is long now. And the thing is, there's 1,000 times the number of knife makers now than there was when I started. This resurgence in this thing is growing exponentially worldwide.
Thanks to people like you.
People. Oh, it's unbelievable.
And hopefully it continues to grow because it is a wonderful craft. And we've talked about on the show before, there are certain crafts that you can do and then you reach a point where you really can't advance it much more. But then there are crafts like knife making is one of many crafts that are out there that no matter how good you get, no matter how much skill you acquire, there's always more to learn. You could, you know, dedicate every day to doubling your skill set and you'd still be on your deathbed thinking about the next thing that you could have learned.
That's pretty sobering set of words there.
Yeah.
75 years old. I'm starting to assume room temperature, so I'm hurrying. Everybody says, can I have a minute of your time? I said, that's time I'll never get back at any price. What are you willing to pay for it?
I don't know, Steve. My grandfather just turned 84 last week, and he still runs a livestock farm himself. So I think it's just about keeping active. I think you've got plenty of years left in you.
Yeah, that's so funny you talk about your grandfather. My uncle, who is 94, I was complaining to him about having to go to the hospital at 74. And he says,
He said, "When did you get in the big league?" He said, "When you're going at 94, the chances of coming out are pretty thin."
Oh, God. Oh, that's rough.
Oh, that's a sobering thought. Drive it. I can imagine pulling into the car park going, "I wonder if this is the dime."
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, no, I literally was out there. I'd forgotten about this podcast. I came in, I sat down, and Laura says, "You got a podcast tonight?" And I said, "Oh my God." And then I couldn't remember who I'd talked to, and I was trying to find it on my phone. It was hilarious. You'd loved it from this end. I looked like a hamster on crack. And I was like, running around getting all the stuff.
It's funny. I was on this end realizing last minute that Florida has two different time zones and wondering, oh, God, have I got the time right?
Well, you were just right on this one, and you had an extra hour if it was the other one.
Yeah. I was here at my computer looking like a lizard in the bottom of a glass jar, just hitting as many buttons as possible, trying to figure out where you lived.
Well, it was contagious because you should have seen me running around in here. There's my I had to get my microphone and then I never opened Facebook or Instagram on my computer before today, so I learned something. Thank you.
You are. Well, we're super grateful that you took the time to come onto the show, and we hope to have you back on in the future.
Oh, sure.
Absolutely. Every so often we do a type of episode called Double Trouble, where we bring on two guests from opposing ends of the same field. And we'll have to get you on with something like Coy Baker, you know, get two makers that build crazy steals.
Oh, yeah.
I've got to go. Unfortunately, I have to leave. I have people...
Well, it is about that time anyway. Steve, if people want to look you up, if for some reason they're not following you already, where can they find you and your work?
On Instagram, it's just Steve Schwarzer. And same way on Facebook. And then my website is steveschwarzer.com.
And you're now offering paid consults as well, which is a hugely invaluable thing for people.
Yeah, I had to do that because, people want me to help them build projects and stuff like that. I don't mind doing it, but I'm just so busy. I got inundated with calls. I couldn't get anything done. So I put that out there, and I charged $100 an hour. That's my shop rate. That's what I charge. But I can save you literally months and weeks of work and a ton of material if somebody wants to do that. And that's primarily for people out of the country or people that have a big project and they can't get to me for a one-on-one class. All my classes are one-on-one and designed around that student. And it's me and them. There's not a crowd in there. And then I got every machine that you can imagine to make a knife with. So,
hopefully our listeners pay heed to that because that's a really, really good offer to get absolutely. That level of expertise on tap. So, definitely, listeners, check out his website and check out that service if you're stuck on something. If anybody has any emails that they'd like to send into the show, you can either slide into our DMs on Facebook and Instagram under the Forgecast, or you can email those questions to ask.forgecast@gmail.com, and we might read them out on the show, and you might get them answered by a guest as well. So
maybe.
Sam, if they're looking for you, where can they find you?
You can find me at Sam Towns Bladesmith on YouTube, Facebook, Etsy, Patreon, Redbubble, The Kitchen Sink. Where can they find you, Alex?
I go by Valhalla Ironworks, and you can find me mostly on Instagram, but I'm everywhere else. I'm like a bad smell. You can't get rid of me. Check out my YouTube and Facebook and everywhere else, Patreon. Thanks hugely for coming onto the show, Steve. It was an absolute hoot to talk to you, and we look forward to having you on again.
Absolutely.
You're very welcome, and I'll be honored to come back. Thanks for taking time to invite me.
It's been an absolute great time, but I hope everyone's doing well at home. Keep those fires lit, keep experimenting, keep having fun, and we'll see you next week.
Bye bye.
See you out.
Wie schon?